This is CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life, with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is the Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. As we know, many victims of rape and abuse around the world and here at home have secretly held their deepest, darkest secrets for years and sometimes decades. And what is now happening is that a lot of them are speaking out. Campaigns on social media like Me Too have encouraged abused victims to share their own experiences. The question that I ask, and many others do, is why have these horrific stories of rape and abuse been kept silent for so many years? Surely the truth can set you free. To tell us of her darkest of secrets, which she held for over 30 years, is good friend Olivia. Welcome to you, Olivia.
Hi, Gary.
Good. Also joining us are two of my favorite people, Luke Lamprecht. Welcome to you, Luke.
Thanks, Gary.
And to Miranda Jordan Friedman. She's Executive Director, Women and Men Against Child Abuse, known as WAMACA.
Thank you, Gary.
Luke, just tell us, I can't keep up with you, who you're with and what you're up to right now.
Well, in this context, I'm working with Miranda on a few campaigns around Child Protection Week and heading up to Youth Day.
Good. Okay, Olivia, I've known you many times for many interviews we've done together. I've known you before that. Let me just quickly say that 11, you were sexually groomed and raped by your tennis coach.
I was, yes.
And it took you 30 years or a little more to reveal the most terrible secret. So who really are you? Are you Olivia? And who are you? Yeah.
Well, I started off Sue Ellen, and I took on Mr. Hewitt many, many years ago. I think it's probably eight years I took him on. Mm. And a year after the trial, I decided I was going to change my name. And the main reason I changed my name is because I was told I was unemployable because of what I had done. So I figured, let me go and become somebody else. Let me go and become a better person, somebody who I wasn't. Mm. And life's good now.
Has the name change helped you in any way?
It has. It's helped tremendously. I actually love who I've become.
Yeah. It took you 30 years to reveal that you were raped by your tennis coach when you were a little girl. Why?
Well, I didn't really have anywhere to go. You know, when he raped me initially, he told me that nobody would believe me. And he also told me that he could get into a lot of trouble. And when I tried to address it with my mom, she dismissed it. In my mind as a little girl, where do you go from there? He told me nobody would believe me, and nobody did believe me.
Mm. When you reached your kind of teens and you got a little older, 16, 17, 18, were you ever tempted to come out with this terrible story?
We did discuss it. I discussed it with my best friend who he had threatened to rape. And we discussed it over the years, but it was always a very brief discussion, and then we kind of moved on from it. It was never really discussed in depth. Was I tempted? Not really. You know, I just try to push it down and suppress it as much as I could.
Do you remember we hosted a woman called Lee?
Yes.
She was also one of the abusees, if I can use that. She was abused by Bob Hewitt as well. But she kept secret. She never, ever came out with it until she saw you, I think, on national television after you had given evidence or something.
Yeah, she actually came to court, and she sat in court. We all hid her away, but she sat in the courtroom with us and watched us give evidence. She wanted to give evidence.
She kept a secret for 33 years as well.
Yes, she did.
There were many other women, girls, that were also raped and abused by Bob Hewitt.
Miranda, 70?
Yes, approximately. I mean, there were, if I can also just add on to what she's saying, is that we were called, we were inboxed, we were of people who were saying thank you to the three women who were prepared to go up against him, go on the stand, were courageous enough to put their names out there and really have both the support but also a lot of criticism. I mean, a very well-known sports commentator phoned me and said, how dare I support the women who are doing this? How dare we name him when we haven't the proof, when this is all just hearsay, etc.? So I really want
to... How did you react when he called you?
I said, I have spoken directly to Venezuelan and that we are 100% in agreement as a whole organization that what she told us is absolutely true and that no woman, man, or child would put themselves through what she is going to put herself through without this being 100% true. Mm-hmm. Worked in this for 25 years. My colleague here next to me has worked in this. We know exactly why children don't talk. In fact, Luke, you mentioned a very valuable point right now about the fact we never even had these conversations around sexual violence. And maybe you want to pick up on that because we spoke about a very famous case and that, in fact, that was probably the first time we even started looking at issues of historical sexual abuse of children.
Luke, before you answer that, as a parent, I have a seven-year-old and God forbid anything should happen to him. There are parents listening that are petrified. We've become a petrified society that God forbid one of our children is being abused and he's not coming out with it. So tell us what to do. What is the answer?
Well, I think the first thing is that, particularly sort of in the Gert van Rooyen case in the late 80s, people never really had conversations with their children about the fact that adults could harm them sexually. I think a big reason was, you know, we lived in a very conservative, nationalistic country where we didn't talk about sex, let alone about the idea that adults could be using sort of sexual ways to harm children. And I think without that language, children can't find a space to talk about it. There's no vocabulary for it. There's no context for the conversation. So the important thing around speaking to children is sending simple messages around the fact that there are things that adults might want to do with you that you're allowed to say no to, but you may not be able to. One of the greatest dangers that we have with our current Say No campaigns is, if you think for yourself, Gary, when do we actively encourage our children to say no to us in any other context? And the vast majority, 95%+ of people abusing children are people that the children know, love, and trust.
That's the scary part.
That's the scary part.
Yeah. And the thing is, we don't ever teach children to say no in any other context. And then if they are unable to say no because of the power differential, what happens is the guilt and shame and the fear of them in some way being complicit because of the grooming becomes unmanageable.
Do these schools, the teachers, the headmasters, whatever, do they teach our children to say no?
Actively, never. Think in any context that you can think of. The only time we tell children to say no is when an adult is trying to do something that an adult should be doing. So instead of saying to the adults, don't abuse children, we say to the children, you must say no when the adult's trying to abuse you. I mean, the conversation is bizarre. So the responsibility that for protecting children was placed in the hands of children through these Say No campaigns, and that leads to a lot of the silence because part of it is that if I say something, I'm going to be in trouble. I did something wrong. Because most abuse that happens with children does not involve physical force. It involves grooming.
Let's look at Sue Ellen and the other 60, 70 girls. I don't know how many they were. They were all coached by this very famous tennis player. They trusted him. In fact, Sue Ellen has often said she loved him.
I did.
As a little girl. He was your hero.
He was.
Isn't this what happens? Isn't this the danger of this whole thing that, as you've said, the people that are abusing the kids are someone that they respect and admire very often?
Almost always. Because that is what gives them access to the children. And as a society, we often start taking on the what we call the defenses. Psychological defenses of the perpetrators, because often there's a denial effect. You know, we can't believe that a priest or a coach or whatever is abusing the children.
Or an uncle.
Or an uncle. Mm. Then we deny the severity of it, which we call minimization. No, it's not so bad. She was just touched, or maybe he didn't mean it. And then the one that's really scary is there's a denial of responsibility that we expect children to be protecting themselves against adults that they cannot protect themselves against, where we as adults should be the people who are responsible for ensuring that our children are protected. Mm. And the fact that children feel responsible is a large part of why they keep secret.
And also the grooming of their families. I mean, look at what happened in your family. So a well-liked, a person who's well-liked by the family, who's encouraged to come over, who parents are happy to let go off onto trips with that person, etc. And so now you are coming out not only as somebody who's maybe not well-liked by your family, so they will probably are more inclined to support you, but somebody who your family, many other families, the tennis community, etc., really like and are fond of. He has huge power. He has huge likability in general. And now you have to come up on your own.
Well,
against
Olivia, yeah.
If you remember and you go back to the trial, my dad sat in that witness stand and said he could never have done it. He's an icon.
For anyone that may not know, what has happened to Bob Hewitt? Give us the answer.
Bob Hewitt is now sitting in jail.
Where?
In St. Albans in PE. On the 20th of September, he'll have been in there for 2 years. Mm. Hopefully he's going to stay for a little bit longer.
He'll celebrate, I think, his 78th or 79th birthday.
He's just had his 78th birthday.
Day. Yeah.
How many years did the court eventually give him?
They gave him 6 years.
6 years.
Mm. So in a year or so, he can apply for parole.
He can indeed.
Yeah. You haven't heard a peep from his family or anything, have you?
Not a word. I'm very actively playing tennis again. I'm playing tournaments again. What has come out and comes out frequently is, why didn't I just leave him alone? He's an old man.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy.
We've
got
common.
Cosby. We've got all these guys that are now coming forward. People are coming forward. Why all of a sudden, Luke? What is it? Is it social media? Is it the Me Too campaigns? Jennifer Ferguson's come out against Danny Yordan. Why now?
Look, I think that there's been a bit of a groundswell around people's ability to connect and not feel that they are. Very often people abused feel they're the only ones. They don't know who to talk to. There's no way to kind of get involved with other people who have shared a similar experience. And what I think social media has managed to do, and the world being a much smaller connected place, is it's allowed for mass messaging. And the minute you have something that, like a Me Too campaign, which is a mass message, people are saying, oh, okay, I'm not the only one. It wasn't something about me. Mm. And that's one of the great tragedies of sexual abuse is the, what we call the traumatic sexualization or eroticization of young children, is that what happens is those young people are often abused more than once by more than one person on different occasions, because there is a level at which the way they have been sexualized sends out certain messages that make them multiple victims, and then they start believing it's something about themselves that has drawn it to them, and that self-blame keeps people quiet. Whereas if you have a mass movement saying, this has happened to all of us and these are our shared experiences, people get the confidence in saying, it's not my fault, it's not about me.
Yes, Miranda.
Yeah, and I think also, Luke, what we've been talking a lot about recently is shifting that blame, that guilt, that humiliation, that embarrassment, from the children or from the adults who've been abused to the perpetrator. And I think that's a very important message for us as an organization and many others, is that we actually have to, because children have been silenced because of the shame and guilt that has been put on them by the perpetrator. And what we really feel is that, you know, let's maybe not even use the name perpetrator. Let's name the people who they are. Like you said, fathers, stepfathers, uncles, brothers, coaches, teachers, priests, rabbis, whoever it is. Let us just say that these people have kept the silence, have bought the silence of children for so long because they have shamed them and kept them guilty. And one thing, and we spoke briefly about the Me Too campaign, but for me, one of the biggest things, speaking to a few adult survivors, is that they feel that really we know who you are. We know that you are out there. We actually can look at you, and we know the people that have supported you, enabled you. So you are the people. That is what we really feel with a new campaign that we will be in. We will let you know all about, Gary, but that is really to change the blame and the shame and put it onto the person who has absolutely caused, who has taken away a child's childhood and in fact has taken away their adulthood as well.
Is that what happened to you, Olivia? Did it take away your childhood?
Very much so. I mean, in fact, it took a good 45 years of my life. You know, I've had to start from scratch and basically start again. So, yes, I lost 45 years.
If it hadn't been for the other girls that had come out with you, do you think if you were alone you would have come out, or you would have said, well, it's too risky, no one will believe me, I don't know whether I was at fault, all that kind of stuff? Is it a combination of those?
You know, Gary, I was very sure of what had happened to one of the ladies. One in particular.
At the time when you were a girl?
When I started to come out. So it never really crossed my mind, you know, what if it's just me? Because it wasn't just me. I was very, very sure of what had happened to Twiggy, because I remember it like it was yesterday. And then obviously there was the other girls as well that I chatted to over the years. So no, that never really occurred to me, you know, what happens if it's just me, or would I have kept quiet? I don't really know the answer to that.
Luke, we have the terrible title of being called the rape capital of the world here in South Africa. I read somewhere a woman is raped every 17 seconds in South Africa. Is that true?
We worked it out the other day, about one in every 10 seconds.
So, oh, my God.
Yeah, so
is this women and men?
Women, men and children. Remember, rape is now no longer, there is no gender discrimination within rape statistics. So that is men, women, children. And they, you know, the stats aren't as aggregated for the different genders. So, you know, I think the thing that it's, I mean, I said to someone the other day, it's strange, it's almost like the penis is the new traditional weapon, you know, that's been used to wage war on our communities. And it's really terrifying that it's a type of violence that is routinely turned to as a way to exert male patriarchy and hypermasculinity and misogyny, and it's kind of just perpetuated by this way that we have raised our young people to see women and children.
Miranda?
Yeah, I mean, obviously my work is mainly with sexual offences against children, but just an organisation like ours, one small organisation in Gauteng with two clinics, sees over 2,000 cases a year of children who are abused, of which I'd say it's actually growing nearer to 90% or some sort of sexual violence. I think the broader definition now of sexual violence has also allowed children to come to us, in the sense of that, as Luke mentioned earlier, somebody who touched a child or you know, with their hands, or penetrated a child with their fingers, or orally sexually abused a child, was really never seen as serious as a child where there had been penile penetration. Neither was it seen of a boy child who'd been penetrated in this way. So I do think that it's huge. It is. You know, the numbers are huge in South Africa. The problem is there are very few specialists. We were having that conversation a little earlier before coming onto your show. Just really, we can count a couple of handfuls of organizations working specifically with criminal cases of sexual child abuse in our country. And this is, and who to refer children to. That's what we were also talking about. But for me, one of the biggest, I think, campaigns that I would like to have for children really is to turn around who the shame and guilt that they take with them for, as as Ellen said, sorry, Olivia, for the rest of her life. And I also feel that, that we need to, we really need to put it where it is. We need to, and people like Olivia, like Twiggy, and all the others who we can't name, their cases going on at the moment. I've another case who's going to court this week. And she, you know, who can actually be free. I feel that we can allow them to come forward, support them. I think, and I hope, with Olivia, that we try to handhold as much as we could them through what they had to, which was the criminal justice process.
How is the criminal justice system, the police, the prosecution, the magistrates, what's going on out there? Luke, you know more.
Okay, for me, the system at the moment is quite broken. So it's broken on a number of levels. And I think from the initial stages, when you're looking at saying to people there's a mandatory obligation to report abuse under the Sexual Offences Act, I mean, that's very nice to say, but how do you access the first line responders? And the first line responders are your police.
Mm-hmm.
So the police at your average police station, I mean, I've had to go personally to open dockets because people want a case number and they say, but there's no one to open a docket, so I'm going to make statements so that I can get a case number.
Mm-hmm.
So the policing on the ground at the first interview level is quite poor. We also have huge issues around the sort of your average medical professional, and the average medical, mind you, and mental health professional, the average medical and mental health professional who is getting these first disclosures all of a sudden panics because they don't want to end up in court and they're not forensic people, and they kind of almost like sort of shuffle around the case a little bit and try refer it to specialist organizations. So there's a real disincentive, frankly, to enter into the formal criminal justice system from a pure entry level. Once you are in the system and the system is ticking over and you at the Family, Child and Sexual Offences Unit, you're potentially in a sexual offences court where you've got good prosecutors, the system works nicely, but that level of distributive justice is just so poor because that level of specialization exists only really in very, very resource centers. So again, the distribution of justice is based very much on where you live.
Mm-hmm. What about the kids in the townships? That's where you have your clinics, I believe?
Yes, yeah. So I have one clinic there.
Excuse me one second. If a child complains of having been raped and goes into the police station,
right,
is there care and attention?
In our particular clinic in Alexandra, there is, but we only have one clinic in Alexandra and our other one is in Ekurhuleni. But the one in Alexandra, one of the important things for us, because there had been really an horrific case in 2002 that I became involved in, and I realized that, you know, Alexandra did not have sort of a really specialized place that children could come and talk to. So when the new police station opened, I spoke to Elizabeth McQuena, who was running the VEP center, and so we looked at putting a facility literally right up above the charge office. So what's happened there is that when children or families come, they get referred straight up to us, and that really is the difference. And if that, I think my colleagues here would agree very much, if that was in every single police station, we would see a very different result. Because then, you know, the charge office is where, as Luke said, that is really where we have our problems. People don't know how to take proper statements down. They don't always want to. They don't understand really, you know, the family violence, how it's involved, child abuse, etc. So really, with us, we are in a very good position there because children can come straight up. And then, you know, they can see our intake worker. They can see our social worker. In fact, Luke does our supervision there. So he has a very great knowledge of what's happening. But also, and I think this is interesting, is that we have a concern there where we see a lot of also juvenile offenders. And the juvenile offenders don't have a place to go. Right now, the courts are not referring. So we have juvenile offenders who will probably be adult offenders. Mm. But let us leave some hope here. And I do feel that, you know, if we could just see a rollout, a serious rollout, and a government will to have specialized centers, like we have one-stop centers where children don't have to be re-traumatized by going for a medical and then going to another building where they have to tell their story again and then they have to have court preparation somewhere else. That if we could have these facilities, and we've said it quite clearly, where we have those pockets, those children will probably
get justice
and be able to go with some secondary abuse. I cannot say there won't be any, but certainly the secondary abuse is very high when one looks at child abuse and especially sexual violence of children.
I know they wanted to roll out children's courts. I think they did one in Cape Town. Is that? Do you know anything about that, Luke? Yeah.
Okay, so they do have specialist courts. So there's different models around court specialisation. They've got two Tuzela centres, which are run by the soccer unit of the NPA. They've got clinical medico-legal centres that are dotted around. But in terms of broad access, they very much kind of pilot sites that are often funded by international money, you know, running kind of parallel systems to the sort of the conventional justice system, which are not really scalable. I don't think we have sufficient skill training of the prosecutors and the police officers and the medical professionals in general. Mm. So you can find these sort of pockets and centers of excellence that shows how the system can work, that the laws are good, that the laws can be implemented, but it's almost based on the personality of the people running it, whether you do or do not get service. It's not a process-driven system. It's almost reliant on personalities to individuals to keep it sort of, to keep the service at a level where we don't harm children more by involving them in our system.
I don't think this is just confined to South Africa. We may be the rape capital, which is a terrible title, but when you think of Lady Gaga and Madonna, they were raped in their teens. Ashley Judge was sexually assaulted at a very young age. Oprah Winfrey is well documented. She was abused at a young age. Queen Latifah. I mean, we can go on and on. Terry Hatcher was abused by her uncle when she was 5. This is terrible stuff. I think the point of today is the silence that these people endure and that Olivia endured must be horrific. And so Olivia has confirmed that. How do we get our kids to talk about it? That I know we're going back to the same point, Luke, but what do we do? What do I tell my little boy if anything should happen to him? What do I tell him?
Well, the first thing you want him to do is you must recognize that a good parent-child relationship is the single greatest protective feature for your child against anything, whether it be abused by other people, substance abuse, running away, behavioral problems, whatever. So the ability to communicate with your children and give them vocabularies for difficult, sort of courageous conversations is the first thing. The second thing is to actually be a present parent. Parenting is not a subbable job. I mean, no matter how good you are on this talk show, anybody can do your job, maybe not as well, but no one can parent your child for you. That's the one job that they can't do. So the thing I always say to parents is your presence, and I mean mindful presence as opposed to just sort of standing around on your cell phone, is probably the thing that will protect your child from most things. And then you need to do some basics. Number one is if somebody does more for your child or likes your child more than you do and wants to give them special lessons and free stuff and, you know, come, you are so multiply talented, go with them to every single practice, every session, every lesson. Because while not wanting to limit your child's opportunities to develop greatness, you cannot allow people to do more for your child than what you do for them. Because that's the first part of grooming. And what happens from there is that once they've developed the favorite, they then isolate the children, and then they get involved in things we call taboo violations. So a taboo violation is something the parent would not allow the child to do. Very common, I don't know what happened with Olivia, but very common in male teens who are abused. These adults will allow them to look at pornography, will allow them to drink, will give them a bit of marijuana, so that they can't go back to their parents and say that something has happened, because they've somehow become complicit. Mm-hmm. And the minute you have secrecy, that is the power behind abuse. So parental presence, knowing where your children are, where they're going, who they're going with, making sure that they're never alone with some person who thinks they're the greatest thing ever. You should be your child's greatest fan.
You know, on that very note, my kid has boxing lessons at home. Okay, the teacher comes there. if I can't be there, which I can't often be because of work pressures, I ask my domestic worker just to sit around.
Correct.
I think he knows why she's sitting sure. there. He's a great guy. I have no doubt he wouldn't do anything, but I'm hysterical about these things because I do too many of these shows and I see too much.
Yeah. That's where the conversation starts. Yeah. The reason that I've got someone here with you is where there's two adults, there's almost no chance one will do wrong.
Yes.
Because it's just simply, we call it I and the child. And as if there's a second set of eyes, I mean, you know, in the work I do and I have to sit with children alone, I make sure either the doors are open or I sit by a window where people can see me. And I do that happily because the children feel safe with that presence. And if something is happening that you need a second set of eyes to see, was that normal, you at least have a reference point.
Olivia, when you think back to the lessons, should your mom have been around more? How did he get you into his car? Where was your mom?
Well, on that particular day, he had collected me from school. But a lot
now
of...
Now, is that... I mean, that's something that wouldn't happen today, I guess.
Well,
certainly not.
I should hope not, yeah. But, you know, a lot of the time in the grooming process, just thinking what Luke is saying now, he had a lot of one-on-ones with us on the tennis court. So, oddly enough, even though there were three or four girls on the court at any given time with him, he would get us into a corner and it would just be small little remarks, comments... Small little things. You know, one of the biggest things I remember is when we were in the States, there were four girls with us, or four of us that were girls, and he called us up to his room to collect pocket money individually. Now, as a 12-year-old or a 10-year-old or however old I was when I went there, I don't actually, you know, it didn't really occur to me that there was something off. But obviously when I got to his room and he was lying naked in his room, yes, something was off. But I never went and said anything to those other girls because of the embarrassment of, oh my God, he was naked.
But you never told your mum about that either, or you did?
I actually didn't. No, that was something that never came up. Mm. But, you know, he did. He got us into spots where we were alone with him. And there were people around us. You know, if I think in hindsight, the one girl's dad used to sit next to that court religiously. He never left the tennis court's side. Yet Bob was still able to do the things
I
that he
did. I think it came out afterwards that many people afterwards, his age group, his peers said, we knew all along that he was messing with the girls.
I was at a tournament in March, and one of the guys said to me, we all knew it. He said, why didn't you come to me and say something? This particular guy was, I think, 2 years older than me at the time. And I said to him, how could I come to you and tell you that this had been happening? They all knew it.
But there's an irony in that's very sad. If everybody's saying, we knew it was happening, why do they then come to you as an adult and say, why didn't you tell me if they knew?
Yes.
Why didn't they do something? So, I mean, it's again victim shifting, victim blaming, you know?
Yeah.
So it's again the shift. If you had have told me, I would have done something. But in the same way, but I actually knew something.
They were all members of the same boys' club. You know, they were all tennis people, and one didn't want to talk about the other, so they kept quiet about it, but they all knew.
But even now, you know, I mean, my story is no secret. At the tournaments where there's 200-300 people at any given time, everybody still whispers about it, and every now and again it comes out that, you know, oh, you're the girl, you know, or you're the woman. Because I walk onto the court and they're like, oh, it's you, you know.
Is it a case of the more we drum into our children, you must tell me if anything happens to you, you must do that. Is that helpful or isn't it helpful?
Well, I think the first thing is we need to teach children how to be able to be confident enough to say that person makes me uncomfortable. Mm. I don't want to hug uncle whoever or kiss auntie whatever on the lips.
But do we tell them don't kiss so-and-so or don't hug?
So there's a level at which we can't pathologize intimacy either. So there's a level at which we have to teach children the right boundaries. Mm. But if a child says, I don't want to kiss granny or hug grandpa, I don't want to go to that person, the simple question is, that's really interesting. What makes you feel like you don't want to go back there?
Mm.
Because often they make indirect disclosures. In other words, they're not saying things directly, but there's a sense of discomfort. Mm. They know there's a gut feeling that something's off. And if you stop it at that point, and you can see with what Olivia was saying, is that he would test them. So what he'd do is he'd have a little snide comment and see if they told. And if they'd have told early on, he would have not targeted them and he would have targeted somebody else who would have kept quiet. Mm. So these offenders, they test children. and the groomers in particular, and if they test the children and they're crossing that taboo and the children aren't going to tell a trusted adult, they push it further and further and further. So it's a level at which if your children aren't happy in the company of somebody, they're allowed to not be, you can go with, you can send somebody else with. Your example of your son, just for in case to watch, you know, boxing is a contact sport, he might get a concussion, whatever the case is, you know, you need someone there as another safety mechanism. But we also do want to...
You can get hysterical over this as well.
That's
what
I'm saying.
You can become an absolutely hysterical parent. So you know, you can't go and sleep out at any of your friends. I mean, you can take this to an illogical stage as well, I guess. Yeah. You know, there's a guy that I've interviewed, and you know him very well, Sam Souza.
Yes,
Reese Mann.
He said that he would not let his daughters out of his sight. He was abused by his... He's rugby coach,
yes.
A few different people. He said he would not let his daughter sleep out. He was hysterical about it.
Yeah.
And I can understand it. Yeah.
But I think just reiterating what Luke said about the fact that you are the go-to person for your child. You are the first. Other people, it's not a whole range of people who fetch your child or have other ways of ingratiating themselves in the child's life, you know, that they sort of almost have a bigger place or a more important place, or the fact that you almost give over to that person. And also what I want to come back to is, you know, like both Luke and Olivia said about the fact he'd say a word or he'd do something or allow you to, for instance, watch a movie out of school, which where you should be at school. Now you are already sort of complicit in the fact that you did something wrong together. So maybe if I hadn't gone to that movie, or I hadn't smoked grass, or I hadn't watched a movie, or I hadn't accepted that present, I would have been able to talk about it. Or the fact that I went two or three times, now I mean, who's going to believe? Why would I have gone back a second or third time? That, I think, is also very important for us to understand, and for parents to understand, that children do. The fact is that they are already in that position where their silence has already been bought, I can say, by those who are abusing them.
We're being held to ransom.
Yeah.
He held us to ransom with the secrets that we were keeping about him.
I love these shows. You people do amazing work. You really do. You save lives, many lives, tragedies out there. And we just pray to God that our kids are not one of the numbers, that's all. Many thanks to you all. Olivia, your life is much better.
I'm such a good space.
You can oppose the parole application, you know that.
Yeah,
so you will be notified.
No,
in
I'm
fact,
done.
Are you?
Mm,
if
I'm
he
done.
Applies for parole, you're going to let it go?
Yeah, I'm done.
You won't oppose it?
He must
yeah.
do what he wants now going
we
forward.
We may oppose it. I want
you
to say
really?
Yes, we will.
I just
we
hope
will.
He's been
we
thinking
will.
Just
about
make sure you get
done.
Notified, and you've got to notify the authorities.
Yes,
you know all that.
Fortunately, yeah. the arresting officer works with our team.
Okay.
A great FCS officer, and we will be notified, and certainly we will do that. We believe he should stay there.
You're getting me all fired up again. No.
The two angels in our studio, Luke Lamprecht and Miranda, double barreled name, Miranda.
Jordan Friedman.
Many thanks. Keep up the good work. We're going to get you back. We always love having you in studio. To our parents out there, I think you've learned a lot today. Just go easy and just be careful. Yeah. Cool. Many thanks to you, our listener.
Yes, and thank you so much, Gary, for having this subject and for having Luke and Olivia. And I think, really, if we could talk about this every week of every year, I think that we'd start opening up a lot of things. And,
cool.
And thank you again for that.
Cool.
Yeah.
To our listeners, thanks so much for listening. Till next Tuesday, I'm Gary Hertzberg. Cheers till then.
This is CliffCentral.com.